Well, on Grace at the Gates, I have, after GA, the hero of the PCA. In 2023, he was the Overture King. In 2024, he was the PCA's moderator. In 2025, he was placed on the Christian Nationalist Committee. And then coming into 2026, he's the interim coordinator of M&A. He's a ruling elder. He's a Marine. He's a businessman and consultant. He's a father. He's a grandfather. He's my friend and yours, Steve Dowling.
Wow, George, that's a real intro. I am not the hero of the PCA. There are many. I'm not one. I'm just I'm a mule.
A pack horse, right? No, you know, like when I first had you on, I called you the Overture King because you really handled overtures well. And then the next year, moderator. And, you know, to everybody, I said it, but you are a ruling elder and just exhibiting godly, gracious churchmanship as you go along. And I know you don't like the accolades, and that's why I bust you with them, Steve. So thank you.
You're right about that. So if there's no other true word on this podcast, we just heard one.
That's right. I'm wearing my M&A shirt, preparing together for the harvest, because we are co-laborers in M&A, of course, myself. You know, I'm actually with two parts of M&A, Steve. I'm with Ministry to State, which you know, obviously, but I'm also with the PRCC. I've been endorsed by our chaplain group and spent 3 days with them in the weekend before General Assembly. What a refreshing time it was. Jim Carter's just awesome, and the whole group is great. And I'm very positive on M&A. And quite frankly, a lot of that, and again, this is, you don't want the accolades, but a lot of that is through your leadership and influence and help in M&A. And that's what we want to talk about, because how dare they cut you off at General Assembly? I mean, have they ever done that before? I was like,
well, nobody's ever forced them to do it before. You know, there's a backstory there, right?
No, tell it. Go ahead. That's what we were talking positive things today.
Well, when I went up there, you know, we had an incredible schedule at this General Assembly. And so Mel had his work cut out for him to just try and get things done in a week, much less any kind of an early finish. And so we were told ahead of time that we really needed to abbreviate our reports and get down to 10 minutes, if at all possible. And when I stepped up there, Mel said, "Are you going to be done in 10 minutes? And I said, "There is no chance." I said, "It's going to take 20. And of course, I didn't think it would really take 20, but I wanted him to be aware that I didn't think I could get it done in 10. So he leaned over and said something to Matt Bradley, which I subsequently learned was, "Take it easy on the clock." So I started, and I wanted to cover like the stuff that's just been the press for the last 9 months, you know, and just get that off the table and say, we dealt with that in depth with the Committee of Commissioners. And, you know, we will, it's your information. We'll share all of that absolutely as soon as we possibly can. What I really wanted to do was get to the ministries. Well, you know, I spoke too long before I got to them, and I realized it. And as I realized that I was running long, I looked up at that monitor above me, and I realized that Matt had stopped the clock. And I said, "Thanks, Matt." And I put him on report. So he had to start it. And, you know, then Mel had to hook me because I just didn't stop. But the truth is, I'm told subsequently that they were trying their best to deal with my verboseness as I went through that thing. And after I made it harder on them, they had to reach out, get the hook, and pull me off the stage. But if you go back and watch it, they are pretty funny to watch while they're going back and forth during that thing. If I'd have had any awareness, I would have definitely been a little more circumspect.
Wow. But, you know, yeah, but honestly, and this, I don't know if you listened to my last, I know you don't listen to me that much, but my assessment of GA was, I called it, you know, the status quo Big Tent GA. And I said right off the bat, I'm not saying that pejoratively or as an insult, but it just seemed like we had major controversies coming in, and there was sort of a unified view that we're really not going to get into them. And, you know, clearly the year before, and not get into them and deal with them in other ways, perhaps, you know, the year before, M&A was in the hot seat. I mean, clearly, and we don't need to rehash all of that. And so that's just to say, when your report came up, people wanted to hear from you. And some of my frustration with the assembly was,
I don't know. I seem to have,
I understand they're battling the tensions of, we have a lot
to do. I've lost you completely, if you can hear me at all.
And
George, I lost you entirely for probably the last 30 seconds.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry.
Did you see me or I was gone?
You were gone. Yeah.
Well, it's recording. So what I was basically saying, Steve, was they're managing tensions at the assembly of they have enough for 2 weeks or more, but people want to talk about these things and how do they navigate it. And I think your report to the point was, given all of the controversies leading up to last year and you coming in, people wanted to hear, you know, like, mission to North America is not a small thing. It is our mission arm in this country, which is what our main task is. I mean, it's the main thing. If you want to keep the main thing, it's M&A. We need the AC for all the administrative umbrella that they give us, and mission to North America is how we coordinate mission, you know? So I understand the tensions they were trying to navigate with not letting it be too long, but hopefully you were able to share. And one reason I wanted to have you on was because you did get cut off, and because I do know your heart. Like, everybody at the assembly level wants to hear about the finances. They want to hear about the scandals and the controversies and all this stuff. And you want to share about all the amazing things you've seen at M&A over the last 8 to 10 months. You know, so that's what I wanted to give you the opportunity to do.
No, and I really appreciate that, seriously, because, you know, there wasn't that much left when I got cut off, but I was also hurrying through everything. And M&A is an extraordinary animal. And I think that a lot of folks, a lot of elders would be very surprised if they got involved with it and looked under the covers to see what kind of an organization we have. And I briefly alluded to it during the earlier comments of my oral report, when I talked about what Irwin was trying to accomplish with one M&A. You know, to create some sort of coherence that you could apply some governance to. And that's a very important point that shouldn't be overlooked, because M&A's got a history. And the history is that really it became an aggregation point for a bunch of individual ministries that were then brought into the tent, speaking of a big tent. So when someone was doing something successfully, like your ministry, you know, Chuck Garriott started that ministry. And it was just Chuck, and he made it go, and it started to see some fruit occur. And as it became more well known, he was invited to join M&A. Well, he was sort of picked up and moved over, and, you know, given the T-shirt, got his tattoo on his arm, and functioned the way that he has always functioned, which is, means to say, completely independently, really, except for back office support. And that was absolutely typical of the way that this organization was built. If ministries were doing things that sort of accrued to the main mission or to a perception of the leadership at any given time to what the mission was, then it seemed like a force multiplier to simply bring them in and aggregate it. And so what you wound up with, in a sense, is a football team and a baseball team and a basketball team and, you know, different sorts of teams all operating under the rubric of professional sports, as an example. They do have something in common. They're professional athletes. These folks have more in common than that, of course, but the heterogeneity is something that I just don't think most folks know. And because it was built that way, you can't really get things that you would like as an assembly, like appropriate reporting. Everybody's doing it differently. You can't get consistency. You can't get, you don't really have clarity on anything, including any kind of transition plans, strategic planning, even at the ministry level. You know, budgeting that's out a couple of years, or any of those kinds of things would give the assembly predictability and then accountability at the level of M&A. So structurally, it's very heterogeneous. But within those things, we've got those ministries are doing stuff that's mind blowing, and they've got no airtime. And, you know, not to have spoken too long about it, which I probably already have. You're going to hook me next. But you know, I'm very grateful for the chance to talk about what they've actually accomplished. Remarkable things.
Yeah. So let's pause there just to, because what you said clicked with me. And, you know, nobody's all good and all bad. Nobody's all perfect or all, you know, wrong. And for whatever you know, I'm the one who says the controversial things, so you can be the more, you know, more political in these things. But for whatever,
of course, we have a policy now, so I would caution.
I know that. And you'll get phone calls if you haven't already. So, but what I was going to say is, whatever you thought about, not you, but people thought about Irwin, whatever philosophical differences they had, I was able to witness that firsthand. That piece of like, MNA was a conglomeration of ministries that were taken under the umbrella. A lot of times they were invited into the umbrella. They didn't even know, they weren't even asking for it. But of course, you know, to be a ministry of the PCA is a pretty big deal. So they come under it. And what Irwin sought to do as it relates to this was, in my understanding, was two planks. Now that may change and have changed, but at least it was a beginning of trying to have one MNA. Is our mission is going to be church planting and church vitality. And you ministries need to fit into one or both. And, you know, church vitality means church engagement. And, you know, like I was coming in right when this was being rolled out or had already been rolled out, but there was a focus on it. And, you know, I took the church vitality, church engagement to heart. You know, clearly we, you know, I'm 100% donor supported, so I have to fundraise. And there's a sense that when I speak to churches and I'm fundraising, that's church engagement. But there's so much more. I mean, right before this call I'm having with you, I was speaking to a pastoral intern at a church in Florida that the ruling elder at that church, they support me. And they're like, this guy is teaching a class on public and political theology here. And he really wants to connect with you. So I said, let's talk. So we just spoke for like 40 minutes on not simply what I do, but some of my perspective and how Christians should view politics or whatever. And now he's going to teach that class. So I'm helping equip a guy in the church. This just happened. So it was, you know, it's an anecdote, but, again, I don't think that piece of things should be lost on listeners about what MNA was when you came in, because everybody's thinking the finances and various, you know, controversies, but there actually were structural challenges in MNA because, like, I love the analogy you used. You know, it's everybody's an athlete, but there's baseball team and soccer team, and so how do you get everybody playing the same game? So, yeah. So go ahead. I completely interrupted you.
No. I think that's exactly right. And I love your recap of it. That's exactly right. And you can't sit back and criticize it for being something that's difficult to govern once it's gotten to scale, because nobody did anything wrong. They did exactly what they were asked to do. And, you know, when it was small, it works fine. As you start looking at how you scale something like that, though, if you're not really kind of optimizing common services and you're not all actually complementary to one another, then you wind up in a situation where you're better off with a bunch of independents not under an umbrella than pretending that you have one. And so that's kind of the mission that I think was started prior to me. And by the way, for what it's worth, it might help folks who listen to the podcast. Nobody led me to that conclusion. Nobody tried to influence me in any way, shape, or form. Murray Lee showed up at my house on day one and said, how can I serve you? And he put himself completely at my disposal. And I said, you know, I think I can solve the financial stuff. It's just math. Obviously, it got deeper than that over time. But I said, you know, we've got to have a source of income. You know, I'd like you to double down, be the face of M&A and go out and work on fundraising. Will you do that? And he said, yes. And he and Samantha Goodman have just done nothing but like support and work and all of that. And about a month in, I came to the conclusion that we had governance problems because there was no commonality. And prior to that, I'd been completely ignorant. So without any influence, without any predisposition to affirm any previous work, without anybody telling me, you know, hey, here, we're this far along that thing. Sounds like you're thinking the same way. You know, maybe you want to pick up the baton from here. I was left to do that on my own, and I'm very grateful for it because it means I wasn't led by the nose. Now we have an objective second set of eyes saying, okay, the foundational thing really was the thing, you know, so that's confirmation. Now, what do we do about it? So the how is substantially different, I would suggest, but the what, that was pretty well identified prior to me.
Did you know what you were walking into? I mean, so Irwin resigns and we need somebody to, Irwin resigned, and not because of the financial difficulties. So M&A just needs an interim. Yeah, yep. Exactly. M&A needs an interim coordinator. And you're like, yeah, I'll do that. Did you know what you're walking into?
Not at all, because nobody knew at all what we were going to find once we really started pulling things apart. No, I had no idea. I had no idea of the level of effort it was going to take. What I thought I was walking into was what we've all observed at General Assembly, you know, which is why are there always negatives on a 5-year rolling average for M&A? You know, I mean, and I feel very guilty about that because I wasn't invested in M&A and didn't really have a dog in the fight and thought, oh, well, they must be paying the light bill because you can still turn on the lights. So I considered it some sort of bizarre accounting fiction or something. But, you know, if you look at it, we go back a long way with negatives showing on the 5-year rolling average for M&A. And it went unchallenged by me. I voted to approve the budget every year, just like everybody else. You know, it passes. But what it really needed was real scrutiny. Now, really good work was started by one of the board members, Brent Anderson, who's a former Bank of America executive. And I believe, I should know better because we spent a lot of time together, but I believe he was in the tax piece of Bank of America. And so he's excellent with numbers and figures and as a finance guy. And he had actually begun pulling apart the financials before I got there. So I had this foundational work that had been done by him where I would say 80% of what we had was validated. And the stuff that wasn't validated was highlighted to maybe the 90th percent level. So we knew at that point the magnitude of like fixing just the financial problem. Well, at a strategic level, the answer is your data is horrible. It's unreliable. I can't ask for anything without getting a different result than the last time I asked you. So what do you do about that? Well, if you're running a business, what you do is you say, I'm drawing a line in the sand. We're going to stipulate what we have, and we're going to clean cut all of that bad data and put it into an iceberg, you know, put it in Glacier out in AWS or something. And we're going to move forward with clean data set so that we can do things in a better way. We can be more accountable. We can report. We can do all these kinds of things. So strategically to make that decision is easy, but executing on it is very, very hard. And it's made more hard by virtue of all of these various accounts that have been started, stopped, abandoned. I'll give you an example. And I know we're wanting to move on to the positive stuff, but, you know, right before we received our audit, we were notified that we had an account that was $5.86 million in the hole. Of course, the back office got excited about that. I still remember I was busy and I didn't react to it whatsoever. And for two reasons. One is, you know, all in, even with the church planters, we're like a $30 million company. What do you think the odds are that we've ever had an account of $5.86 million that we could be negative $5.86 million on? They got to be close to zero, right? So I knew that this was an accounting fiction, that something had happened and that money was being paid out of other accounts while all of the debits went into this one account, which of course is exactly true, right? So in my economy, what you do is you know, that's part of the bad data set that you've got to isolate. You got to find the source of it and you cut it off. Well, how do you do that? Well, you kind of got to go backward, like you're reverse engineering the way that you organize your business architecture. You know, in the traditional way, you go out and you map everything you've got. You say, what are all my organizational artifacts? Where are all the shekels? You know, where are all the people? And they become artifacts and you build out what you need to change to get to your strategic objective. After several years of consulting on that kind of thing, I decided that that's so much effort, nobody ever gets done with it. And I adopted the philosophy that you reverse orchestrate your business architecture. By that, I mean, you say, what's the outcome got to be? And then you kind of create a constraints model backing off of it, saying, well, for us to meet our mission, we have to do A, B, and C. Okay, what's it take to do A? And the example that I use to communicate it to people is, how do you make fire? Well, you need three things. You need fuel, you need spark, and you need oxygen. Well, oxygen's ubiquitous. I don't have to spend a lot of effort on that requirement to make fire. But I do have to discuss how I want to ignite it. And I do have to discuss what fuel I'm using. Is it wood? Is it gas? Let's say it's wood. What kind of wood? You know, and you can fan out all your options behind it, and there might be 1,000 of them. I don't know how many different kinds of wood there are. But when you apply that to business, you know, you're and you go from the thousand types of trees up to trying to create fire. There's a reason nobody ever executes that very well and gets done with it. Usually they'll give up on an enterprise architecture according to a traditional framework that operates in that manner. So my idea was isolate, cut it off, and have good information moving forward so we can do the things we were told to do, which is what also led to what have we been told to do that you read in the report.
Right. Okay, where do I want to follow up with that? So how did you get, okay, so you came in to look at, you came in and you started looking at the financial stuff. How did you come about understanding you actually had to change some structural things? So besides the finance side, the organizational structure.
Yeah, well, I wasn't aware that there was no really, I knew that the general fund was paying for a lot of stuff, but what I didn't realize was it was every man for himself as far as getting your paycheck. And, you know, there are various philosophies out there about how it works to be a planter or to be to be laboring in ministry. And in M&A, you know, everybody really was required to go out and get enough support so that they could pay their bills, right? And what that means, of course, is that that's got to kind of be primary, because our first responsibility being to God, our second one is to our families. And if you can't pay your electric bill, then you have to stop what you're doing and go out and ask people for the support so that you can get back to work on the mission field. And so I was kind of negative about that just as a concept. You know, it seemed to me that there needed to be better security there, because otherwise, how do you create effective outcomes? You know, if you've got to leave the field because you don't have enough support, what happens to the ministry, the people that you've been, you know, teaching, training, you know, praying with and all of that? Well, you're out doing that. So, you know, you go, well, obviously, then if I want to create, you know, a strategic plan that has outcomes that we can all look at and tell the assembly about, but I have an unreliable labor force because they're forced to be self-interested first, and I say that with no criticism of them, then what can you do to mitigate that so I can achieve a better outcome? When you start looking at it that way, you start tucking into, well, how is all of that handled with every man for himself, getting the funding being put into accounts and so on, and what is it being about the mobility of those funds between accounts? And that was very uneven. And so those kinds of factors started to kind of, you know, matriculate into the macro problem of who was paying for what and how. And that's what started the string pulling on where's our process. Well, over the years, we changed the language on our giving site. The language that was up when I arrived actually didn't do a thing for us to give us any liberty to move money in any way. So in one ministry, they had a brother die. There was money in his support account. The fact is that money was given for a specific purpose. It was solicited for that specific purpose. And you can't just randomly move it. You got to go talk to the donors and say, will you let us give it to his wife, or will you let us do whatever? And that's a trivial one, but at a broader level, we all know from the report, you know, what that looked like with more substantial sums. And so as that string got pulled, it started to reveal these various cracks that kind of led to the conclusion that you can't change the culture if you don't change the financials, and you can't change the financials if you don't change the culture. So, you know, we kind of drew some lines in the sand with the policy on how you move money, which made it legal for the ministry leaders to make intelligent decisions like, what do you do if a brother dies? Are you at liberty to give the money to his wife? And to create clip levels where they could do that unrestricted. And then at other levels, they had to get permission. And, you know, at yet another level, you got to go to the permit committee so that they actually approve what you want.
Let me jump in on that just to, you know, my own observation, or to give people maybe, you know, an example, like, because my listeners will understand ministry to state. I talk about it all the time. You know, we have one person in each state capital. And, you know, I replaced Jonathan Craig, who was the Florida state capital minister. And I saw real time the conversations, like how to deal with his account. So he leaves the field. He goes active duty in the military as a chaplain. everybody gave to, did they give to Jonathan Craig or did they give to Ministry to State Florida? Well, it depends on how they wrote the account, right? Now, common sense, I think, would tell everybody that that money would go to the next person who fills his shoes, but it depends on how it was written, right? Yeah. Now, again, it all got worked out, you know, obviously. So yeah. I don't think I'm speaking.
But everything had to be worked out individually and as an ad hoc and idiosyncratically.
Yes.
Right. You know why? Because you touched on it. Common sense. One of the most profound things I ever saw was, you know, every Marine Corps officer has to go to the basic school in Quantico for 6 months. They had these big classrooms with wooden counter desks in front of you when I got there back in 1981. And 82, it's been a long time. Anyway, I sat down like day one and I looked down. Somebody had a lieutenant had defaced government property and carved into the desk, the basic school, where common sense is an uncommon virtue, which is a play on that famous saying about, you know, where courage was a common virtue or uncommon courage was a common virtue. But that thing stuck with me the rest of my life, you know, and it really attenuated my expectations of common sense, even in myself. You know, we don't always have it.
Yeah. Did you know, you don't know this. I actually went to Quantico, Virginia Officer Candidate School for one summer.
Did you?
Yes. Yeah, I decided not to go back. You know, I was in the two summer program they do in college. You know, I went the one summer. I'm not going back.
The platoon leader class, PLC.
Yeah, that's it. That's right. So I saw that desk.
It was a good one.
Yes. But yeah, so one of the things that's been enjoyable for me to see, knowing you, you know, previous to this and your personality and your heart, and I mean, you're very organized, but you have a very soft heart, I think, is how you've navigated the changes, the leadership, and it wasn't always smooth. And yet it's not a year. And I just see it's like night and day from when you came in. And so I knew you didn't know I was going to say that, but my point is, you know, it's never comfortable when you get a new leader, particularly when the one who's leaving was beloved in the organization and you're coming in and uncovering all kinds of things that need to be thought of differently, structurally. And that's not comfortable for people who have been swimming in that ocean for a while. And I, you know, so I got to watch the organization, because you've had, I don't know how many phone calls, you know, open calls. What are you calling them now? I was on the one on Monday.
Town halls.
Yeah. Town halls. You've been very accessible to everybody and you actually follow up from those calls. So they're, you know, even me, I'd ask a question or say something on a call and you'd reach out even after the call, even though you answered it, to make sure that my understanding was, you know, if there wasn't any more follow-up. And I know you did that with dozens of others, and it's just a real beautiful unity in M&A, which is what you'd want. And that is, again, you know, Lord has used you in that. And I know it's come at personal cost. You've worked a full-time high stress job, and this M&A thing is a full-time job. Like, it was supposed to be part-time. It's not. But you are able to dedicate full-time now to it. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, I definitely think, though, not to contradict you, because God has just obviously been present and has blessed things, you know, even the practice things early on, he seems to have like just handled for us. But the cost of the first cost, the biggest cost of that whole thing was, given the intensity of the problems, I didn't get to tuck into the relationships and the ministries the way that I would have. You know, when I talked to the PC, I was like, yeah, you know, if you want to have great results, you've got to be able to hold people accountable. And you can't hold them accountable unless they buy in. And they're not going to buy in unless you've got an environment where they can say what's on their mind, because that constitutes healthy conflict as opposed to unhealthy conflict. But none of it ever happens unless you have a foundation of trust. Well, walking through the door, I didn't have that, you know, of course. And therefore, to bridge the gap to get to the results was the most important thing. And that's the thing that I don't think has been done well, and I'm very much looking forward to by being able to do this full time moving into to next June. Because what happened where I was able to get involved with some of the ministries, like show up at the PRCC board meeting, you know, I became aware of both the nuances of the organization, you know, and what they were really doing, you know, and that kind of thing was so energizing that I started to see what the real cost was on not having the cycles to do it all, right? The cost to me personally, you know, I'm 70 years old, and it is true that especially at the heat of the detective work, you know, I was working from, you know, 5 in the afternoon till 2 in the morning sometimes. I was up at 3 sometimes. Old people can't sleep. So I was doing that work in weird off hours. And it's just not the best thing for you, you know, and the context switching between a full-time job and trying to do meet the requirements of this job, which were, you know, as you pointed out a couple times here, were pretty extraordinary. Did take a toll. You know, you can't sit at it. You can't sit for 16 hours a day. You just can't. I mean, it'll kill you. So I already feel better about that. So there's a little bit of a personal toll. And there was no financial toll. You know, I, in fact, I couldn't accept any kind of compensation and remain employed. It would be unethical. You know, so I had to parse that out and make sure I was doing everything I was supposed to be doing. But the real cost is the first thing. You know, those are put in the proper order. The real cost was, in a perfect world, I'd have been focusing on the relationship building that built that foundation of trust. And if anybody's familiar with Pat Lencioni, I just described his pyramid from the 5 dysfunctions of a team. And, you know, that trust thing will create results. So what I've done already, you know, now is I've created an agenda to be intentional about seeing people, have regular, you know, virtual calls, but I'm going to go see people. I'm going to talk to them. I'm going to know what they're doing. I'm going to see people in the field, and I'm going to show up at presbyteries and follow kind of the John Bice model about, you know, making sure I'm doing everything I can for people to know how great these individual ministries are and to really understand that what we're doing is we're working on the trunk of the tree, not on the beautiful fruit that's coming out of the branches. You know, there's just something foundational with the tree. Dean Faulkner, when he talked to the Committee of Commissioners, took a briefing. And I'd read the notes to that, George, a week before the COC meeting. And I was like, well, I don't want to do a report after you do that report, because I'd say those exact same things. Why don't you do a joint report for us? Well, by the time he got to the COC 5 days later, he had fundamentally turned that into a sermon. And it just made me feel like God was present. I've never heard another report like that. I thought it was a thing of beauty. But he used the metaphor of a house, and it's a lot like the one I just used with the tree, you know. There's great things happening in every room of the house that he built or in the branches that I was talking about. And, you know, now's the time to go out and just do better there.
Yeah. Wow. So what are some of the surprising ministry things you learned by working, you know, at M&A, some of the things the Lord's doing that you want to highlight, some of the things you got cut off and you couldn't say, or you had to abbreviate, like what are just. Yeah, share from your heart on those things.
Well, can I start with one that, you know, is our biggest problem, DR?
Yeah, start with whatever. Yeah, man.
Yeah, because I couldn't say this at the General Assembly because despite the fact I abused everybody's time, we didn't have enough time to deal with this. But when we're talking about the financials and the problems with the way money has worked there, that is one problem set, but it's not the whole of DR. The actual truth is that the rest of DR, like what it actually does, what the men who are in, and women who are involved there are actually doing, I don't think could be done better. I'll give you an example. A guy named Mike Kenimer is running the Rome warehouse, which is kind of like operations central for M&A DR. I went there to visit the whole team in probably 3 months ago or 4 months ago. And I got there early. Mike was there early. And so we had time together to just walk around that warehouse and to look at it. And, you know, one of the things I learned that was a moderate surprise to me, because I didn't have a financial record on how we refill that warehouse. It wasn't obvious from the books. And so I had a fundamental question about it. Well, a lot of the stuff in that warehouse, if not all of it, is donated. It's directly donated. So while on the one hand, you report that cash was not going in the way that it should have been going to disasters, stuff was going and people were going and vehicles were being deployed out of that warehouse and through the regional directors in a way that honestly is world class. I mean, it's fantastic. And with Mike in particular, his attention to detail with things like warehouse inventory, brother, he knows where every screw is in that warehouse. And when I asked him how he accounted for it all, he printed me off a sheaf of papers that was about this thick. It's every item in there. Now, if we had that kind of attention to detail in all of our, last however many years of the life of M&A in the financials, we would not even be here today. I mean, so, you know, I think it deserves saying that we have a problem and it's significant, but all of the where the rubber meets the road piece of M&A DR is mind blowing. And it's handled with that level of attention to detail and that kind of faithful stewardship across the board. So, you know, I think one thing that I'd like to just get on the table is that M&A DR as an organization is a phenomenal response organization. And we need to figure out what we really want them to do, whether it's more heavily towards relief, because they also do mercy ministry there. Or do we invest more in response and expect, you know, more centrally delivered? But that's under discussion right now. One thing I know is that from an execution standpoint, they're bulletproof.
Yeah, well, I'm so glad to hear you say that, because I'm a big, big fan. Met of you in the year and a half before I left. We did 10 different trips or trainings with DR. We were in Augusta, Georgia. We were in Arden, North Carolina. We've been at the warehouse. They've been up to do Bobcat training. We've delivered sheds to them, and it really is a phenomenal thing. And you mentioned Mike Kenemer, Mark Becker came up from Texas. Steve Jessen was in our presbytery, yep. And
Kurt Moore.
Yeah. I mean, these guys are, you know, they're not wasting money. I can tell you, I know their budgets. Mike actually emailed his out. A lot of what you said too is important for people to understand. Again, I don't know, where all the forensic accounting is going to end up. I know you said you'll communicate that hopefully next year. But like, it's almost like a lot of these storms are pay it forward. So, North Carolina storm happens, which, that was 2 years ago now, I think. It's not like suddenly they're trying to figure out how to get flood buckets and sanitation stuff. It's in the warehouse from the previous efforts or from building up, or I know we would leave people's basements were flooded, and so we'd leave I don't know if it's blowers or vacuum, something to air the thing out so it wouldn't be moldy. And quite frankly, I always wondered after we leave it, like, how do we get that thing back? Because the next team's coming in. And so, well, that was a new blower that somehow was donated and probably money came in and they bought them because they had, the same blowers we were leaving all over the place. And there's not a great ability to get these things back. And so anyway, my point is, same thing with chainsaws. When they would mobilize chainsaw teams, they were the group in Augusta is just fun. You got to go down there at some point. I don't know if they have it set up all the time, but there's a site. Is it First Pres Augusta? They have sheds and trailers full of this stuff. I'm a big fan of DR, and I'm glad you said that. And this is a good from a pastor's in a church's standpoint, even though I'm not right now. What I loved about it is, of course, I loved to help the people, particularly when it was in North Carolina and I was pastoring a church in North Carolina. We felt a solidarity with those needing help. But disaster response through M&A helped mobilize my people. And so our whole church, it was a rural church, but medium size, so good size for the area we were in, and just a heart of these people to want to help but not know how. And Steve Jessen was able to mobilize us and train us and utilize us. And so here I'm seeing like discipleship of my people through DR. So yes, it's doing mercy ministry. And this is what I've argued with people, you know, over coffee or cigars, and they say, you know, they want to be ordinary means of grace, which I am 100% about. And so how does DR fit in that? It's because, well, it's discipling my people. So when I'm on a disaster trip, I can mobilize guys that want to do things. They want to use their hands. They want to use their efforts, and they want to use their energy. And often those guys aren't always the ones in the Bible studies and the prayer meetings. But if I go and spend 3 days with them on this trip, I'm learning about them. I'm pouring into them. I'm discipling them. And you know what? When they come back to the church, they feel greater connection to the body of Christ.
Yeah.
And DR provides that platform.
Yeah. So. Yeah. You know, yeah. To Arkby Houghton's credit, he built that from the ground up. And all of that stuff is real. You know, no matter what's happened with the financials over the years, that's a problem that we all have to share in, right? But the outcome, you know, talking about having strategic outcome based sort of vision and budgets, you know, they have one, and they're doing great. So they deserve praise. And it would be a very difficult thing to go, hey, you know, DR's got all this problem. Oh, by the way, they're really, really great. To me, that in the Marine Corps, that's painting rocks. You know, it's like you're trying to bury the lead, or you're trying to mitigate what you're really saying. And I'm not built that way. That's why. I mentioned it during my oral brief, but I knew I was going to write an article for By Faith talking about these ministries and praising them for what they do. But I was unwilling to put the same thing into that report. You know, the assembly had been waiting to find out information about the financials and the problems that we were confronted with. And they deserve to know that we have a wall in front of us that we've got to climb over. And to do that and then go, oh, by the way, you know, everybody's awesome. It just, I'm genetically incapable, brother.
Well, let me help you.
Analyze those and just go, we're doing this thing. I'm talking about that now. And now I'm talking about this.
Well, but let me help you and maybe even encourage you, or who would I be to advise you? But, you know, like the individual people, God willing, like whatever happened with the finances at the top level of DR, you know, Mark Becker, Steve Jessen, Kennemer, you know, they have individual donors, as do I. Like my budget is the way it's currently structured is my budget. Now it's under oversight, but like when you give to George, you're giving to George. I pray that the individual missionaries that are out there, and I don't know anybody that's 100% funded, but
I know continues. Two ministries that are.
Okay.
All right, because we're moving down that road.
Bro. I know, and I want you to move move even further. But my point is saying this, and this is hurricane season's on the horizon. We might be in it right now. I don't know if we'll have a storm, and M&A is going to be asking, DR will ask for money as they always have, and that's the pot that people are going to be questioning. And I think that's the area. And I know, obviously, I don't need to advise you on this. And it's like, it needs to just be clear that because we want people to give to it. So you got to be clear about the protections in place when you're asking for that.
Yeah. And we are 100% going to do that. But one thing, you know, you can't do is you can't say, you know, every penny that you give us is going to go to this. We won't even take out administrative fees. Nobody can do that. Everything costs money to do. I mean, you know, so I don't think donors are going to care much if you just say, we have X amount of overhead involved, or we're going to use it. We're using a bunch of stuff out of the warehouse. This is a hypothetical. We're using a bunch of stuff out of the warehouse. You know, we're going to run through chainsaws like they're butter knives, you know, plastic ones, you know, and we've got to replenish that stuff or we won't have anything to help with the next one. Where people have that knowledge going in, which, to be honest with you, I expect most of them believe that anyway. Now, I don't know that yet, but I'm going to find out.
Well, so let me add into that just to help, you know, because I thought so many, you know, I speak on things, and I've been biting my tongue on this because I don't want to speak. I don't know. But what I know as a business person, and what I know as when I was a pastor of a church, that when we were collecting money, and again, I wasn't associated with M&A. I assumed it was going, if somebody gave to a storm, it would go to allocations as a result of the storm. I assumed that. I could have been wrong in that. In other words, if the storm used you know, 500 storm buckets out of the warehouse, that money would go to replenish that. Or, you know, when people, when Medivh used to give to Steve Jessen, and they still do, God willing, I assume that's just a normal part of his support for the year. Like, now that he's in a storm and he's zigzagging North Carolina and using extra gas and spending extra hotels, I assume that money that was being donated to the storm was helping him as the main coordinator, you know. And so I don't know if that's the way it works, but, and it doesn't. So you're saying it doesn't. Well, no,
it didn't, but it should, because it's okay. Very legal.
Yeah, right. You got no, a guy. It's allocation. It's just you allocate the money to things that are related.
George, it's all procedural at that point. You know, again, this is the difference between having governance that keeps you safe from authorities and not having it. It's entirely in balance for people. Like, picture Mike Kenemer work in the warehouse, you know, what amounts to 24/7. You know, they got bunks in there. I don't know if
he lives there. I know. But, yeah.
You know, all you have to do is contemporaneously mark that time and document expenses, and it's reimbursable, and it's totally legitimate under every regulatory body known to man. That is absolutely expected, right? But if you say you're not going to do it that way, then you can't do it that way.
The statement on the website.
Well, not just the statement. There's more to it, but I'm literally not at liberty to go further than that right now. But you'll see it all.
Yeah. I'm not pressing.
And some of it you'll just go, oh, well, I think everybody thought that was happening, you know. But now it will be, and you know, it'll be put in a framework that's gone through legal scrutiny and everything, so that we know. And we won't deviate from it. Again, this is that organic problem too. A lot of it was just like, what do we do with this? Well, let's do that. Well, that becomes your standard, right? And it's not, it isn't where it belongs. So, but the bottom line here is that, you know, that's a technical problem that can be remediated. That's just setting up the goalposts and calling plays, going down the field and getting it, you know, getting your touchdown and winning the game. This is one little part of it, right? All of the rest of it is a complete, you know, season or a lifetime for the athlete. Go back to that metaphor. And that's the part that is absolutely bulletproof, right? This is one game that I'm running right now, and I'm going to do my best to get to the goal line by June of next year. And if I don't, I know they're going to bring on a guy who will be able to finish the job. So.
Are you on that committee or you're not on
no,
that committee? Okay.
No, well, that's right. Anything to do with it. It's the permit committee.
So what other highlights do you want people to know about the good work going on at MMA?
Well,
we are cheerleading here. It's fine.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about refugee and immigrant ministry, because that was one that got left off.
Okay.
Now that probably surprises you, but, you know, going in blind and only knowing that we'd had a few gaffes by putting up things on the website that you know, sounded like they were trying to help people evade the law or were critical of the governmental authorities placed over us. You know, I thought, I don't know what I'm going to do with that ministry. You know, it's run by a woman named Angela Pacey. And, you know, Angela is a very bright woman, excellent writer, by the way, really good. You know, I thought I need to invest some time to understand that ministry. And oddly, it was one that I did invest some time in understanding. And the reason that I did was because I could not understand how we could effectively do refugee and immigrant ministry without being political, because it's so inherently political. You know, the law can change pretty rapidly, depending on the administration at the top, leaving people in situations where, you know, they're like morally, they feel like they just need to violate the law, you know, that it doesn't matter because it's transient, you know, it's not determinative or whatever. And so what Angela and I have discussed at some length is, you know, can you have a ministry like that that produces any value that's purely biblical and doesn't touch on any kind of political thing? And I think it is possible to do
that.
Can
I ask a question on that?
Sure. Yeah.
I know I keep interrupting you, but just because that way listeners are following. So like, are you saying like, because the ministry, any ministry, like take a church. I mean, I was at a church in South Florida and we wrestled through this. Like, can we help people who are breaking the law? Is that what you're referring to?
Well, I think that
can you show mercy?
That's a danger for a a ministry, MNA, who's been given a mandate by the General Assembly and has executed that mandate by starting ministries to do different aspects of what they believe matriculates into the mandate. So in other words, it's a branch going back to the trunk. And you saw that in the report, I found three core things we were supposed to be doing that the assembly told us to do. And I said, we are only going to do these things until you guys just tell us to do something different, right? We're going to focus. These are our lanes. So in that case with RIM, we're not in a position where we should be answering the question, you know, can you help immigrants? Those are local problems, right? But when we were providing resources, the danger was and remains that you can find a resource, and this is really why the notoriety came. You can find a resource that looks like it's a good resource and you link to it or something, right? And you didn't do due diligence. Well, how much due diligence do you need to do? Well, we had the experience a few months ago where and Angela and I have been working closely. She's been incredible about running things by me. And she said, I'd like to link to this website. Will you look at it and see what you think? Well, I went to it and I was like, oh, this is very innocuous. I mean, this seems perfect, right? But I know better. So I started punching around in it. And by the time you get three layers deep, it's got an obvious political position. It absolutely has an anti-government flavor to it and so on. But it's not immediately obvious. And it isn't actually even obvious upon pretty close scrutiny. It's only there if you go ahead and exhaust the effort to chase out the entire website. And then you go, I see what the mission is here. And so well, the thing that pulls us off mission and really contaminates our ability to help is not just saying, you know something, we're just going to scrutinize anything. And if it smells like it has an impact or we're sending some message or creating a position with respect to the law, we are not going to do that. We are simply going to deal with how you equip, enable, and penetrate communities. So as an example, one of the things I think that they're doing that's extremely meaningful is that Angela's got an advisory board. These people, like most of these advisory boards, are populated with long ball hitters. These are people who know what they're talking about. And I was invited to a board meeting, and the guy who spoke on that, you know, who kind of had the part of the meeting where he got to profile what he was doing, was an Iranian, and it was the height of the conflict with Iran. And, you know, he was talking about the fact that there are hundreds of thousands of Christians in Iran, a fact that was completely lost on me prior to that, and that they were completely incommunicado. You know, the government had shut down every kind of communication within Iran. They had no idea what their family was going through, what they were doing, whether persecution had ramped up. I mean, it was a black box, right? So, you know, what I took from that, and I won't try to replicate what he said, but it wasn't highly emotional, but it was terribly moving. And, you know, what I took from it is that what these folks are doing here is they're anticipating what's going to happen months, maybe years down the road when the situation changes. Neither some Iranians are liberated to leave or they're being persecuted and then they flee and all of that kind of thing. You know, how do you catch them and how do you just show the gospel to them when they get to the United States? So the dynamic tension there is can we have that ministry and should we have that ministry? And whereas previously I thought, no, we just shouldn't have it. I don't know how you divorce it from the political environment. And why do we want to expose ourselves in that way and create controversy within the denomination or be used as a foil for those who have an agenda outside the denomination? But I've kind of moved. I've kind of moved over. I think there is a way to do it. And the way you do it is by just scrupulously saying we want to be biblical, we want to provide resources, and we do not want to advise on legal interactions or any of the rest of that. We're going to treat it like kryptonite. One last line. This is the bottom line is that I think there's been a material change in the ministry. And Angela has been super fantastic about like working through it, making appropriate changes, helping me to see things differently. And the fruit of that ministry is actually pretty extraordinary, especially when you look at what I did talk about, which is the outrageously competent performance of the ESL team.
Is the ESL under that?
No, they run in parallel, although I can see why we might want to join them, but they're doing functionally two different things. And you know, I've talked a lot, but I'm going to shift horses real quick on you to ESL. I did brag about them, but just to say a word about the woman that runs that, Nancy Booher, you know, in the couple of years ago, the leadership went to her and said, you know, what would you do if you were able to have $50,000? She said, I would write a new ESL curriculum. And they said, okay, go do it. Well, she got a contractor for it. And I bragged at General Assembly that it's the bestseller at the CDM bookstore. The people in the field that I have heard from universally think it's the best thing, that the best curriculum in the country. I mean, that's the kind of praise that this thing gets. Well, Nancy is contemplating retirement. And I thought, oh, you know, business mind, George, this will ring a bell with you. I wonder if she's got the rights to that stuff. I wonder who owns it all. Nancy set it up so that it was 100% owned by M&A and was going to succeed her. I think that's notable, especially when so many of these ministries grew organically. And I don't really think they would have thought in many cases to say, what about the out years? But she did. So this ESL program is already positioned to well outlast Nancy. So, yeah, they could be joined. I see a lot of commonality, and it might be helpful to join them. On the other hand, I think I need to talk to the people who are in ESL ministry, you know, and find out whether not just the staff. I can talk to them anytime, but I mean the people in the field, and see whether that creates any sort of unintended consequences or complications where we wouldn't want to do it. We're pretty tightly joined right now, and they're close.
Right. So, you know, and once again, from a pastor standpoint, because I've been pastor in multiple churches longer than I've been under M&A. Once again, ESL helps mobilize the church. And we saw that in South Florida, where I was, church in Hollywood, Florida, that it engaged our members to do acts of service. And it's just an amazing program that mobilizes your body. And so, like, and what I like about ESL also, a completely different aspect, is there, I don't really see, it doesn't seem to be like a factious thing.
Right.
I know, you know, again, if we put the labels and maybe the Bryan Chapel sense, the progressive churches do it and love it, and the confessional conservative churches do it and love it. I believe Fred Greco's church has done this. I know Todd Pruitt's church does this in Virginia. And just, I'm glad you were able to highlight that again. I don't want to have to put you in a position to have to highlight every ministry and then potentially leave one out.
I know I already burned all your time, brother. I think we probably
yeah. You know, it's like as a pastor, you want, if you get up and during announcements and thank people that served us something, you're always going to leave.
I got to hit one last one though.
Yeah, go for it.
Edit out other comments. Bill Sim with Korean Language Ministries is a 10. He's a leader. He's God's man. He is so biblically centered that I covet time with him. He is a true, honest broker. And his ministry, the ministry that he runs, and he's scrupulous to say Korean Language Presbyteries, not Korean Presbyteries. But Korean Language Presbyteries is to make sure that we retain this huge footprint that we've got in the Korean community by recruiting and bringing over and training up ministers who will be able to communicate in native Korean language. Now, Bill wrote the part of the Lilly grant that gave him nearly $500,000 to spend on that. He went to Korea a few months ago, and in Korea, he met with the denomination over there that, you know, was, it's the largest reformed denomination there. And he, I'm trying to look up the name of it. I think it's Kosin. Yes, it's the Kosin church. And they had the moderator, he had the general secretary, the permanent committee members, you know, presbytery leaders, that whole group, met with Bill. And he was able to participate with them and advance that mission. And I'm sure that not every one of your viewers knows that the biggest church in the PCA is a Korean language church. I mean, we have a huge footprint.
I didn't know that. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's big, you know. And John Chua doing City Lights ministry, they had a dedication in D.C. I talked about that a little bit. But the impact that those churches are having. Now, that one's bilingual. So they've got both native Chinese, American Chinese, and also, you know, Caucasian Americans on the staff in that church. So that's a really unique experience. But those kinds of things, you know, getting to know those kinds of things and see those, the dedication and the kind of activities that they're doing, really is mind blowing. And, you know, and trying to speak at 120 words a minute at GA, there's no way to do it justice. There's really no way to do it justice here. But if people could see it, participate with them in some way, I really think that they would find it so spiritually energizing that it would transform at least part of their spiritual life.
Yeah. Well, good word, Steve. I, you know, I hope we can all unify around M&A. I did get the sense that people were frustrated with some of the past scandals, but were hopeful for the hopeful in the direction it's going. And that was good. And you know, I think that was reflected both in the committee of commissioners. I was in the room. I wasn't on the committee. I was in the room for as long as I was allowed to be there, and in the assembly, you know. And I think you're a straight shooter and a straight talker, and you basically, you know, you're like, yeah, we can't tell you certain things, but we will be able to. And I saw a general sense of trust in that. And so obviously I'm big on M&A. I don't know that M&A's success is like, I'm relying on M&A's success with ministry to state, but I see the importance of it in our denomination, and we ought to have a strong M&A. And so thanks for your work in that. And I think, again, I'm seeing a sense of stability and peace within the organization. And, you know, the challenge is going to be when, because everybody's warmed up to Steve. The challenge is going to be a year from now.
I hope everybody has. I don't know yet. We're testing that now.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, I don't know everybody, yeah. But that's the sense I have on these calls, even from some people that felt to me early on were standoffish. They seem much more loose and light on the call, and that's a great thing. And then the challenge is going to be when we get the next person and how that transition takes place. And I know the committee is working on that. So are you able to speak at all on the Christian Nationalism report, or do you want to avoid that completely?
No, I think though that David Strain did a beautiful job talking to Ryan Beasy around that. And I think it's worth listening to. And one of the things about his leadership on that committee is that we absolutely did not think we knew it all. You know what I mean? And, you know, I was the primary author for what got published as the constitutional section. It's got errors in it. You know, I didn't realize that we didn't catch them. One of them is a cut and paste error that's very egregious. But the point is that getting the extra time from the assembly is going to make it better, because the kinds of conversations that have happened that David's able to, like, I show an amazing capacity for getting all that information. I don't know where he's getting the hours in the day. And then having that kind of interaction hit the committee report, you know, the work you did, those nine sections, you and I compared notes about whether I'd stolen stuff from you, but I didn't. I actually had written that in February, but I wouldn't have been averse to it. And neither is he, you know, and I just think that that distinguishes him both intellectually and as a leader. That we are going to produce a better report because of it, because people have picked it apart and fairly, you know, some of them not so fairly, but I mean, for the most part, it's been pretty fair and has really provoked thought at a different level than we were able to do as a committee, because that's a huge topic, because nobody knows better than you.
Oh, it's so hard. And you know, I feel bad because I've critiqued it, but I've tried to keep the critique to disagreement over statements, not, you know, ad hominem or whatever. And I always say, maybe it gets overshadowed when I maybe disagree with something, but I think it, the majority of it is great. And when I say the majority of it, not like a section or not, like the overall thing is great. And there's a few tweaks I'd like to see in it. And honestly, like I appreciated you, you know, coming up to me as that debate was going on and just, you know, affirming that my motion to just send down the pastoral letter wasn't offensive to you, because that I thought that was like a way to honor the committee's work, but then just not send any, you know, maybe a wrong message or a message that could be misinterpreted to presbyteries or the world. And, you know, right after the assembly, there were articles written in, you know, Tennessean, and I've seen memes come out that say, you know, PCA condemns Christian nationalism. And I mean, that's just a broad brush that the report isn't doing. And that was my concern with sending it down when we didn't adopt it. But I do appreciate a lot that's in there. And it shows, you know, that you guys were very conversant with everything that was kind of going on. And truthfully, there's never going to be, this report will never be something everybody agrees with. I think it could get to a place that I can fully agree with it, but
you know, part of that was addressed in the parts you didn't see. So, you know, one of the reasons why the glosses I made, because you'll notice that the constitutional part isn't footnoted at all, right?
You I don't remember, see, but yeah.
You should see the other work.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, it's so heavily footnoted, it looks like a dissertation. And I think that it may have been the case that we let some of my more, you know, Marine Corps direct kind of statements go because they were going to be they were kind of a synecdoche where the whole follows behind showing like a much more textured view. But no, you were not offensive in making the motion. In fact, David walked down because I happened to be in the front row because I think I was up soon or something. But he came down and said, I don't have a problem with that. Do you? And I said, no. So as far if that vote would have gone, send down the pastoral letter. That he didn't have a problem with it, neither did I. So far from being offensive, we thought, yeah, maybe not a bad idea.
Yeah, all good. Well, I appreciate the heart behind that. And yeah, we'll be in prayer for the committee's ongoing work. I want to do a lightning round with you. And so the first thing that comes to your, like, don't dwell on these questions too much. I want to tap into your inner Steve. So what's your favorite movie?
Oh, Idiocracy.
I don't even know if I've seen that. Who's in that?
Oh, man. Luke Wilson.
Oh, okay.
Terry Crews.
Okay. I don't remember.
It's a Mike Judge movie. It's got horrible language. I can never recommend it, but it's by today's standards, it's
fun.
Pretty much what you hear on every street corner, but that's the beauty of it. It anticipated today's American culture in a way that I think was Mark Twain level.
That is all. I did not anticipate that. The Marine, I thought you were going to give me some war movie or
no, history movie. No, number two is The Princess Bride. So, I mean, don't, no.
Well, maybe my wife will actually watch one of my podcasts now that you said that. Okay, good. What's your favorite band or musician?
Tom Petty, secular, you know. And
yeah, sure.
I rediscovered recently that I had a youthful passion for the Newsboys. Because I'm walking again, losing some weight. And you know, that's on one of my playlists. And I ran it this 2 days ago. And I was like, I liked those songs. I did.
The Newsboys.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. But you said Tom Petty. So that's.
Yeah, well, Tom Petty's like, you know, as far as secular music goes, there's nobody better.
What'd you listen to in high school? What genre of music?
I listened to everything. I did. Yeah, I was pretty cosmopolitan about it.
Classic rock, which in your day was just rock.
Yeah, it was just rock, you know. But yeah, I think we all did, you know. And I wasn't saved. I wanted to be a hippie, you know.
Yeah.
But the Marine Corps got a hold of me, and thankfully, and then God got a hold of me, thankfully, and I wasn't able to follow my worst impulses. So.
Uh huh. All right. Favorite food.
I would probably, well, you know, the one I eat the most is steak probably, but favorite food, you mean type?
Whatever comes to mind. Type of food, sure.
Yeah, I like Asian and I like Indian, but probably chicken tikka is my favorite. And if it's not that, then it's Thai food like Panangs.
All right. Good. I'm trying to think of other eccentric things to ask you. I think we hit it, man. I appreciate your time and I appreciate what you're doing.
Yeah, I appreciate you, brother, and what you're doing, too. And everybody, if you stayed to the end, please remember George was using hyperbole at the intro. He's doing that because he's a friend.
Yeah, Hey, so tell us how we can be praying for you and your family and your work. Just some prayer requests that can be public.
Well, my father-in-law is about to go to glory. We got called out of church on Sunday to go to the hospital, and we went through his advance directive and everything. He's 92-year-old. Lifelong pastor. And, you know, he thought he was checked out. He'd gone septic and, you know, they had him on antibiotics, but that wasn't you know, everything. He really looked like he was going home, and he was totally ready, and wasn't the Lord's will. So the antibiotics worked. He's kind of rebounded, and now they want to run more tests, and he's not willing to do that. So he's they moved him to home hospice care yesterday. And the reality is that we all know where he's landing. And so there's no grief involved here, but mostly the concern is, you know, like literally for him, you know, is not to second guess God. He'll go when God says so, but I would pray for him to have the patience. And if I was able to ask anybody to pray for anything, it would be that, because he's anxious to see Jesus, and it didn't happen on Sunday. So here we are at Thursday, and I know he's coming.
Wow. Okay. Well, by the time this airs, who knows, but, yeah. And I would just ask everybody to keep you and your family in prayer as you know, juggle a lot. And I'm glad you're able to do this full time now, but I'm glad to also hear you're working on your health. And I never viewed you as overweight, but definitely at the assembly, you looked more fit. And so, I was happy to see that. Yeah.
Well, I'm made to be about 190. So okay. I got ways to go, but thanks, George. Now everybody knows. I feel like I was just on Oprah. I have lost.
Good deal. Well, thanks everybody for watching. If you've enjoyed this, you could watch a former episode with him called Overture King, which is maybe 2 years old. Please subscribe to the channel. And a shout out to my friends at Birmingham Theological Seminary. You can find them at bts.education. If you're thinking of getting a DMin, or just starting studies, or a ruling elder that wants to brush up on their poly, whatever, they're starting classes again here in a few weeks, I'm not sure, sometime in August, so you can get their bts.education.